Chapter 4. Burning Heaven. Prisoners. The Falcon and the Cage. Cordelia Void Habitat. Uranus High Orbit. The stream of plasma flicked across the domed viewport, touched the next dock spar along from the Antaeus, and cut it from the habitat in a silent burst of fire. A kilometre-long arm of stone and metal hinged free of the station, then began to tumble away, scattering molten debris. The ships, locked into the docks on the severed spar, fell with it. One ship fired its engines to try to get free and ripped the skin from its hull. It flew into the void, spinning, scattering its guts to glitter against the light of the planet. A blast wave of micro-debris hit the Antaeus a second later. The hauler's hull rang as though it were a tin roof in a hailstorm. Cadmus Vec saw cracks spread across the dome as pieces of shrapnel struck it. The ship was shaking in its dock clamps.
"Get us loose!" he shouted.
"We have to wait for the captain," called Submistress Colm. "She was on the main dock limb."
"You are the captain now. Get us free," he shouted.
"But
now!"
Colm hesitated. Her lined face was pale, eyes wide with growing panic. Some of the crew around her had stopped. Some even looked like they were about to make for the bridge doors.
"No, I can't," began Colm. "The captain..."
Vec pulled the pistol from his gown. It was small, but it felt heavy and strange in his hand. Colm looked at the pistol as he levelled it at her. Shock pulled her mouth wide.
"Cast off," he said.
He saw anger flush red into her face. Something huge exploded in a starburst of blue and white beyond the dome above. Colm flinched and nodded.
"All stations make ready to cast off. Begin the count." "There are still people crossing in the dock limbs," called one of the junior officers. "Sound the disconnection alarms," said Colm. "They will run if they want to live."
Vec could see anger hardening in Colm as she gave the orders. She would never forgive him for what she was having to do. If she found the courage, she might one day try to kill him for it. If they survived the next 5 minutes, he could live with that.
"Reactor output rising to 60%,
called Chi 32 Beta. Out of all the crew, the engine seer seemed the least concerned about the events unfolding around them. Hunched and swathed in her robes of patchwork red and dirty white, she moved between the bridge systems as though there was no hurry in the world. The rest of the crew were scrambling to get wired into their posts, shouting orders or questions.
"All systems confirm ready to cast off," called Colm.
The replies came, rattling off loud, tension finding an outlet in noise.
"Engines aye. Helm aye. All specs aye."
On and on. The hull was vibrating now, as cold machines woke in its guts. The Antaeus was a small ship, barely a third of a kilometre from stern to prow. Most of its bones and skin had been hauled from a wreck drift and remade by skilled hands now long dead and forgotten. It was neither fast nor slow, but it had reliably moved indentured labour and ore between Uranus's moons and asteroid belts for centuries. It had stood up to pirates and survived a conquest that had been renamed Compliance. Now, Vec hoped she would prove to be the survivor again.
Colm turned.
"There are still people running along the dock limbs towards the ship. We can't cast off."
"Give the order,"
snapped Vec.
"And if you truly listen, Lord and Master of Mankind," he said in his thoughts, "have mercy on me for this."
Sweat beaded on Colm's sagging cheeks and hung from her chin.
"Seal all doors and hatches," she said.
Lights flashed on consoles. Quiet had fallen across the bridge as suddenly as the falling of an axe. A junior officer looked up at Colm and nodded.
"Release anchor cradle. Release docking limbs."
Colm looked back at Vec, fire in her eyes again, lips pulling back from teeth to spit whatever she was about to say. A glint caught Vec's eye. He began to look up at the dome in the roof of the bridge. Something huge was moving across the pale circle of Uranus's light. A flash. He opened his mouth to shout. White light, so bright it swallowed sense and sound. Blindness, gasping. The metal deck beneath his hands and knees. Then a roaring, shouts filling his ears as he rose, neon scars swimming in front of his eyes.
"Full power to engines!" shouted Cole.
She was clinging onto her command console, her face drained of colour. Something struck the ship, and the deck pitched. Beyond the viewport, the void was on fire. Cordelia Habitat was gone. Chunks of debris rode a silent wave of destruction, spinning like pieces of shattered rock. He could see the shapes of habitation clusters, and the long tines of a dock spur with ships still locked in place, their hulls holed, fuel and air trailing after them. The Antaeus lurched, and the view slid, and he saw streaks of light slicing across the stars, flashing the colours of jewels, burning topaz, ruby fire, cold sapphire. Ships moved across his vision then, either so fast or so close that he could see their jagged outlines with his naked eyes. Hundreds of them. Thousands of them. It was almost beautiful. The ship bucked forwards. Pitted metal plates began to slam shut over the view. Colne was shouting orders.
"Drop us down fast, then cut power. If we do that, we'll lose manoeuvrability,"
called one of the other officers.
"We won't be able to get... You want to look like a threat to whatever just cooked the whole habitat?"
Colne yelled.
"Follow your orders, or you can go and join those we just left behind."
Those we left behind. Vec found that he still had the dead weight of the pistol in his hand. He looked down at it. He was shaking.
"Sir?"
The voice was low, pitched to draw attention from him but no one else. He looked up. Axinia stood just by his shoulder. He felt a wave of relief at the sight of the life ward. She had served his mother before him, and his grandmother before that. Tall, with the willowy thinness of the Voidborn, she looked as though she would break at a touch, an impression enhanced by the signs of her age. Ash-white skin clung to skeletal limbs, dotted with dark liver spots. A crest of false, carbon-thread hair sat atop her head, and she held herself straight and stiff. The grey and black mesh-woven fabric of her long coat and the white lace at her cuffs and throat complemented the impression of a noble's tutor or widow matriarch, an impression that was utterly false. She was old, that much was true, but he had seen her move so fast you could blink and miss it and break plasteel with a blow from her open hand. He caught a reflection of himself in her implanted optic lenses. A man running to fat, swathed in a heavy silk and brocade gown, dark skin sheened with sweat, a gun that he was not sure how to use hanging in his hand. The contrast with the woman who guarded his family was so stark in that moment that it might have made him laugh.
"Are they safe?" he asked.
"In the captain's quarters, with Nikal and Koba standing guard. It might be too much to hope that they sleep, but they are quiet at least."
Axinia gave a small smile, and the wrinkled skin of her face creased beneath the black lenses of her eyes.
"Oh, if we all had the strength of the young."
"Thank you, Axinia," he said,
and heard the crack reach into his voice.
"For everything."
Axinia gave a small shake of her head, still smiling.
"It is my life and my service, sir."
He nodded, not sure what else to say. She was the reason he, his daughter and his son, were alive. It had been her who had picked up the threat alert on the habitat's command comms channels before the alert sirens were triggered. That had given them enough time to alert the Antaeus and reach the dock. Barely.
"How many?"
he began. His eyes pulled back to the gun in his hand.
"About 1,000 made it onto the ship,"
said Axinia, replying to the question as it caught on his tongue.
"Most of them are in the cargo holds. I took the liberty of ensuring that the bulkheads to the rest of the ship were sealed. They are in shock for now, but that won't last. And shock and grief can change to anger as reality sinks in."
He nodded. People had swarmed towards the docks as the sirens had wailed, driven by raw terror. He could remember, years ago, when the news of the Warmaster's rebellion against the Emperor had arrived, there had been riots. Peace enforcers had been brought in. There had been deaths, arrests. After that, the hand of the Praetorian had fallen firmly on everything and had not let go. Harsh order and unforgiving rule had settled on them. Uncomfortable at first, but then familiar. Vec had seen some of his assets seized, stores of metal ore requisitioned under edict, and two of his family's hauler ships pressed into service as troop transports. Others had suffered worse, too. But discomfort was not loss. Time had passed, and the fear that war would come to the solar system had become a promise that would never be fulfilled. There had been incidents. The aerial mining operation shutting down, the alert and lockdown, a wave of detentions. But the lies put out to explain them had been enough to return people to the comforting sense that the conflict was a long way away. That state, like the warships passing through orbit, the checks on movement and the ever-watching eye of authority, had just become the way things were. Life had gone on. When Axinia had woken him a few hours ago and said that he and his family needed to get to a ship now, he had wanted it to be a lie.
"And how many were in the dock when we cast off?" he said.
Axinia shook her head.
"I don't... Sir," she paused, "that is not a wise question to ask."
He looked at her and was about to reply. The ship pitched. Lights flashed across consoles on the bridge. Warning chimes sounded. Vec looked around.
"Blast wave," said Coln without looking around. "Callis station just detonated."
Her voice was cold, shuttered with control. "There are a lot of big energy and mass signatures out there. A lot."
"Warships?" Vec asked.
Coln shrugged but still did not turn to him.
"We only have basic navigation sensors. How am I supposed to know?"
"Signal incoming!"
shouted one of the deck officers.
"Source!"
called Coln.
"Small craft is close. Maybe a shuttle? The message is in, clear,"
said the signal officer.
"It's a distress call using solar void cant."
"Cut it," said Coln.
"We can't..."
"No,"
said Vec. The sound of his own voice surprising him. Coln looked at him, and he could see the anger rising up her neck, flushing colour into her face.
"They could be anyone," said Cole. "It's a military craft. Picking it up makes us a target."
"Everything out here is a target," snapped Vec.
"You order us to leave thousands of people behind, and now you want us to..."
"We would have died with them,"
shouted Vec, his own anger rising.
"This is someone we can save."
He shook his head, exhaustion quenching the rage as quickly as it had ignited. Coln was looking at him, confusion plain on her face.
"This is someone we can save,"
he repeated, turning and dropping into an empty seat beside a console. Coln looked at him for a long moment and nodded.
"Answer the distress call," she said.
The shuttle's rear hatch released with a hiss. Mercedes unfastened her harness and then paused. Nihlus was already up out of his seat and moving towards the opening hatch. He looked back at her.
"Come on,"
he said. She did not move.
"What in the name of the stars could be keeping you there?"
Mercedes shook her head. A sudden feeling had flooded her, drowning the relief she had felt when the ship had answered their distress call. She had come to as the shuttle spun through a void, filled with the flash of explosions, racing towards the promise of a sanctuary. Now the sudden quiet of the hangar, after the outer doors had closed on the fire-touched void, somehow felt more threatening than the light of battle and the flare of dying ships. Nihlus frowned, the expression creasing around the metal plate riveted to his forehead.
"What?"
he asked. The hatch touched the deck outside.
"Out!"
came the hard command.
"If you have weapons in your hands, we will shoot. If you do not comply, we will shoot."
Mercedes took a deep breath, raised her hands and walked out into the light. The hangar outside was small, a box of weathered metal just large enough to take the shuttle and leave space for the group of figures that waited for them. There were five, two nervous-looking troopers in blue and silver uniforms, which were too clean for them to have seen much use, a very tall woman in black and grey, another woman in a blue and gold braid uniform Mercedes could not place, and lastly a heavy-framed man with polished walnut skin. Bonded opals dotted his forehead, and his eyes were cautious. One of the troopers shifted his grip on his shotgun.
"Who are you?"
snapped the woman in the blue and gold-braid uniform.
"You're the captain of this ship?"
asked Mercedes.
"This is smelling more wrong by the second,"
snarled the uniformed woman at the heavy-set man.
"Please," said Mercedes. "I need to speak to your captain."
The very tall woman raised her hand. She had barely moved since Mercedes had exited the shuttle. The woman's face was old, but there was a strength to it, and a sharpness to her gaze that reminded Mercedes of a sword's edge.
"That shuttle is a Corona-class lander,"
said the tall woman, carefully, without looking away from them.
"Well maintained and armed, but with no markings. Military or paramilitary. But look at her clothing."
The woman pointed a long finger at Mercedes.
"Worn. Utilitarian. Nothing metallic, even on the fastenings. Alphanumerics stitched into collar and cuffs. Prison garb."
The tall woman turned and looked at the man with the opal-studded brow.
"Sir, you own this ship. What do you wish done?"
The man stepped forwards. He looked exhausted, thought Mercedes, as though the universe had already piled more onto his shoulders than he ever thought he would be able to bear.
"Who are you?"
he asked, looking just at Mercedes.
"My name is Mercedes Oloton," she said.
"Why were you a prisoner, Mercedes Oloton?"
She looked at him, thinking of what the truth would do in this moment, and then gave the only answer that came to mind.
"I can't say."
"Then you must remain a prisoner on this ship," he said, and nodded to the tall woman.
The troopers moved forwards.
"Please,"
said Mercedes, sudden panic rising as they gripped her arms.
"I need to reach Terra. I need to reach the Praetorian."
The officer in blue and gold braid laughed, and then turned away as the troopers shoved Mercedes down to her knees and bound her hands behind her back. Bab Bastion, the Imperial Palace, Terra. Su Kassen heard the door lock behind her and closed her eyes. The smell of her chambers grew as she drew her breath. Relief crept into her for a moment as the quiet inside replaced the pulse of the sirens outside the palace. She remained still, letting the moment stretch as she held the familiar scents in her nose, the tinge of holcar smoke, cold stone and old fabric. As senior officer of the Solar Defence Command, she rated a mansion complex amongst the Imperial Palace's tangle of towers and halls. She had avoided having to refuse such an offer by requesting a billet in the Bab Bastion itself. Rogel Dorn himself had asked her why.
"I learnt my craft on warships," she had replied. "I rest where I fight."
He had nodded but not smiled, but an hour later she had been granted her request. The Bab Bastion stuck up from the mass of the Imperial Palace like the stump of a felled tree. Half a kilometre wide at its base, it was a cliff-sided block of undressed stone. It had been built when the land around it was a wasteland. For decades it had sat inviolate as the palace had grown around it, replacing the desolation it had guarded with colonnades, domes, and statue-capped spires. There had been rumours that it had defied multiple attempts to level it with increasingly apocalyptic quantities of explosives, until the Sigilite himself had ordered the Mason armies to leave it standing. Now, with gun nests crowding the palace roofs and void shields sparking above the armour-coated towers, the Bab Bastion's defiance seemed less of an ugly reminder of the past and more of a warning of the future. When Rogel Dorn had begun to fortify the palace in the wake of Horus's treachery, he had made the Bab Bastion the seat of his command. And for half a decade, a cluster of three small rooms set one-third of the way up its northern face had been Su Kassen's home. Sleep. By all of Jupiter's storms, she needed sleep. A static crackle ran over her skin, and a smell of burnt dust and storm charge replaced the taste of smoke. They were test-firing the Bastion's tertiary void shields again. She opened her eyes and was met by the gloom of the main chamber. She blinked and hung her uniform jacket from the iron hook on the wall without needing to look. A pair of round eyes lit at the other end of the room as Kellick woke. A clicking caw disturbed the quiet. She smiled and went forwards, picking up the falconer's gauntlet from a low table.
"Hush," she said. "It's still day. Not time for you to hunt yet."
The gyrehawk gave another unimpressed call as Su Kersen released the catch on the cage. Kellick eyed her for a moment and then hopped onto her arm, ignored the gauntlet and climbed up to her shoulder. His claws dug into the ballistic weave, and she winced. He blinked once, slowly, giving the distinct air of contempt. Su Kersen laughed and moved to light the water pipe. It began to bubble as she moved around the room. A low table of ancient cedar sat at the centre of the room between two worn floor cushions. A Saturnian power sabre hung on the wall above a brass-framed box that held one of the twin shot pistols she had taken from a drift pirate captain in her first ship action. Long ago now. She should sleep. She only had 2 hours before she was back on station. But she knew she would not be able to. And besides, she found more rest in these few moments of mundane reality than in the dreams that would come to her if she slept. She was drawing a cup of spiced tea when Kellick flinched on her shoulder, head suddenly raised, eyes open and fixed on the door. The knock came a second later. She froze for a second. Who would come to find her here? If it was an alert or crisis, there were procedures, signals. But the vox set into the chamber wall remained silent. She lifted the shot pistol out of its box, loading and cocking it with practiced smoothness. There were guards throughout the bastion, security screens, and warriors of Dawn's Huskarl retinue. But something had sent ice prickling her skin, and she had nearly died enough times not to ignore that warning.
"Identify yourself,"
she ordered, levelling the pistol at the closed door.
"One who would have your counsel," came the reply.
Su Kersen felt the breath hiss from her lungs with surprise. Then she shook herself and released the door lock.
"My apologies for disturbing your rest, Admiral," said Jagatai Khan.
"My lord,"
she began, bowing her head.
"Please," he said, smiling and bowing his own head. "The impoliteness of an unexpected visitor negates all need for formality."
"What has happened?"
she asked, mind still whirling.
"Nothing," said the Khan. "At least nothing that requires you for the moment."
His eyes were like shards of ice catching sunlight. His presence was like the touch of the wind blowing across a mountain. On her shoulder, Kellick gave a soft call and shifted his perch. She shook herself and stepped aside.
"Please,"
she said, pulling the Trigorian words of hospitality from memory, suddenly aware of the shot pistol still in her hand.
"Enter as a friend."
The Khan's smile broadened.
"I am humbled. May fortune flow from your generosity."
He bowed his head before stepping forwards to pass through the door. The movement was slow, she noticed, unhurried, like the padding of a snow leopard across a glacier. All of that inhuman, dazzling speed was absent, replaced by poise. He did not wear his armour, but a coat of soft black leather, lined and edged with white fur over layers of silk. The jewelled pommels of knives gleamed at his waist, and silver rings circled his fingers with falcons and snakes. His hair gleamed with oil and clinked with beads of copper, lapis and moonstone. He looked, she thought, just what he was, a warlord untamed by time or place. She motioned to the cushions on the floor, tapping more glow globes to life. The Khan's gaze moved across the room with a fleeting glance that she was sure had taken in every detail. His eyes paused as she unloaded the shot pistol and replaced it in its box beside the empty space left by the other half of the paired weapons.
"A spoil of battle without its twin," he said, sitting on one of the cushions. Arrayed in half-plate and silks, he somehow looked utterly at ease in the small space, despite his size.
I gave the other away,
she said, offering him a glass of spiced tea.
To another warrior?
He said, accepting the glass and taking a sip.
To my daughter.
Of course. Where does she serve?
I think you know that, my lord.
She held his gaze for a second. His smile dimmed, and he nodded.
Captain Kalia Sukasen on 2. Last recorded deployment as officer commanding the Thunderbreak. Attached to the 63rd Expeditionary Fleet under the command of the 16th Legion. The Sons of Horus.
She nodded and held his gaze. Her thoughts had gone very still.
Yes, my lord.
Prior to the betrayal, of course, he added.
How may I serve, lord?
She said, taking a seat opposite him. He looked at her and then around the small room.
You have doubts about my brother's method of fighting this war?
I helped devise the battle plans, lord. I have no doubts.
She paused. The Khan smiled, but his eyes had moved to where Kellick still perched on her shoulder. The Gyrehawk gave a soft caw, unfolded his wings and glided to the Khan's wrist. He grinned, eyes flashing as they met the bird's gaze.
A Jovian void officer who speaks Chogorian, keeps a Gyrehawk, and serves Terran spiced tea on a table of cedarwood. You are a strange example of your kind, Admiral.
Perhaps. But are those things truly strange, my lord? I grew up in ships, in orbital shoal habitats, in corridors and spaces of metal where there was no sky, and trees lived only in tales.
A cage, said the Khan,
raising a finger and stroking Kellick's crest.
You lived in a cage of ideas. You broke its bars and now find more comfort in reminders that life is more than iron and stone, and death in darkness.
I like things that are different from what I knew.
She shrugged.
But after this time is past, after your rest is done, you return them to their cage. You put back the ideas and oaths and become the warrior that you were made into. You go back to the small spaces you ran from.
Sukasen felt herself frown. The thread of this conversation had flowed and turned in just a few moments in ways that made it difficult to follow. It was as though there was something that the Khan's words were circling, but not touching, some end which she could not see.
The first reports from Uranus arrived just after you left the command chamber, he said,
then glanced at her, then looked back at the Gyrehawk. Kellick flicked his wings and opened his beak wide. Sukasen had the sudden impression that the bird was smiling.
A beautiful creature. Too beautiful to be in a cage. Keep one like this from the sky and it will go mad. You let him hunt, though, I can tell.
When I can, I take him up to the parapets and let him fly.
And he always returns?
Yes.
The Khan smiled. Then his face darkened, the expression like cloud passing over the sun.
The sirens sound outside, on and on. At Actinus Hive, an hour ago, 10,000 people took their own lives by sealing a zone of the hive and cutting off the air that kept them alive. The last message from inside the zone said that they could hear the howling of wolves when they dreamed and when they woke. There are others, too, smaller in scale but multiplying by the hour. Mars has fallen silent. Fire and fear spreads and spreads. Just before I knocked at your door, I was told that there have been pleas from Triton and the moon colonies of Neptune. They can see the battle light from Pluto. They are asking for the ships taken from their orbits to be returned. They want help. They want the Praetorian of Terra to save them.
Silence filled the moment.
Uranus holds?
She asked at last. She thought of the ships, the hundreds of ships that had been redeployed from other planets to bolster the defence of the Elysian Gate. She thought of the resources pulled from Neptune to bolster Uranus's defences. She thought of the cost paid by every enclave left undefended so that the traitors would have to fight and bleed to control Uranus and the gate it guarded.
"I am called the Warhawk," said the Khan. "But maybe only because I was given a sky to fly in. My brother, Dorn, has only ever known cages. Duty, honour, strength. And for every bar of every cage that has been placed around him by someone else, he has made those bars stronger. He has made his cages smaller and stronger, until to spread his wings would rip him apart."
The Khan raised his arm, and Kellick spread its wings and glided back to Su Kassen's shoulder.
"You are right to question the way that this battle is being fought, Admiral," he said. "You are right to allow your heart to doubt, and you are right to speak those doubts to my brother. He listens to you. He trusts you. And the way that he is choosing to fight this battle is maybe the last cage that he has made for himself."
"You think he is wrong?"
"No, I think he is right. But that what he is having to do is breaking him. But he needs to hear the voice that tells him the price and lets him choose to do as he must. He needs to be allowed the moment of flight before he returns to the cage of necessity."
The Khan stood and bowed. Su Kassen rose to her feet, but he raised a hand to still her.
"My thanks, Admiral, for your hospitality and for letting me speak as I will."
She bowed her head, unsure what to say. The Khan walked to the door, opened it, and then turned, looking back at her.
"The enemy have come through the Elysian path off Uranus in great force. The orbits of its moons are aflame. But Uranus holds."
He gave a sad smile.
"It holds."